Union Court of Appeals is now in session. The Honorable Kareem K. Martin, Daniel R. Foley, and Craig H. Stockmore presiding. Please be seated. Case number 27855, Ohana Authority, Ohana Yiki, Ohana GMO 340, and Sierra Club 20, Chapter 1st Board of Agriculture. David A. Weber for appellant, Isaac Morikawa for appellant, Isaac on next.
May it please the court, good morning. I'm Weber, Deputy Attorney General, representing the Board of Agriculture, and with me is Hanani Burns, also representing the board. Approximately 25 years ago, after complying with the Hawaii Environmental Protection Act and completing two environmental impact statements, the facility now known as the Nelha Natural Energy Laboratory facility on the Big Island in Kailua Kona was constructed. Those facilities included facilities that for more than 20 years have been used for the production of algae, among other forms of aquaculture and mariculture. In November 2004, Mira Pharmaceuticals, which was a then current and I believe still current tenant of that facility, applied for a permit to import certain strains of algae under the provisions of Hawaii Revised Statutes Chapter 150A. The algae were genetically modified strains of a common microorganism that is on the list of restricted microorganisms that do require a permit from the Board of Agriculture before they can be imported into the state of Hawaii. Under sections, HRS sections 150A6 and 150A6 parens 3, and the rules authorized by Chapter 150A, there is a standalone comprehensive process for review of such permit applications. In particular, the statute requires that the board consider potential deleterious or potentially harmful impact on the environment, on agriculture, horticulture, and public health and safety in the course of approving such permits. And the rules established there in Hawaii Administrative Rules Chapter 471A, those rules establish a fairly rigorous process for this purpose.
We had an incident a couple years ago at Lake Wilson where that algae sort of took over the whole lake. Were those imported algae at one time? And were they so, would it have
I
helped to have a heat evaluation?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor, but I don't know that. I've forgotten the name of the substance, but we do remember that well. And so far as I'm aware, that was not imported under the permit process. But I cannot speak to that. The board in this case, under the established rules, the requirement was that the chief of the plant quarantine function at the Board of Agriculture reviewed this permit and in his discretion determined that although this organism was on the moderate risk list, he determined that it was above moderate risk because of a number of factors, including in particular that it was a GMO organism and one that they had not dealt with.
One of the arguments, as I understand it, is that the 2000 amendments to Chapter 150A resulted in superseding the HEPA requirements. Is that correct?
That would be one way to put it, Your Honor. I think it's perhaps more accurate to say that in this context, because here we're certainly not talking about altering or building new facilities, absolutely nothing whatsoever would be changed at the existing facilities that have been there for many years for production of algae. But that in this context, this permit process stands alone, and that Chapter 343 simply doesn't apply.
Well, but prior to the 2000 amendments, would it be your position that HEPA did apply to importation pursuant to permit of various things that are subject to permit by the Department of Agriculture?
I think that the prior versions would be the same argument we're making today would apply to that. However, the 2000 amendments manifested both a clear legislative purpose.
This is, give me the hypothetical. Assuming that the DOA's action involved use of county land, so take away that issue. All right, so prior to the 2000 amendments, would a permit application that involved action involving the use of state lands, would that have been subject to HEPA?
Again, assuming no alteration of existing use, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because although the process prior to 2000 was not as clear and specific or as rigorous as it is now, following the 2000 amendments.
So your position is HEPA never applied to the Department of Agriculture's permitting process?
Standing alone, I believe that's correct, Your Honor. However, I would hasten to add, first of all, we're dealing with the law as it existed post-2000, and in fact in 2004 when the permit was initiated. But we're also dealing with a situation in which the facilities involved...
I'm trying to take that out of the equation. In other words, assuming it's a permit application that involved the use of state lands, assuming that's correct. Okay.
Yes.
So in other words, it would otherwise meet the HEPA requirement. It would be an action that would otherwise be subject to HEPA. My question to you is, prior to the 2000 amendments to the Department of Agriculture statute, which you seem to cite as a basis for superseding or taking away the requirements of HEPA, I'm saying prior to that, would a Department of Agriculture action that involved the use of state land require compliance with HEPA?
An action to permit the import of a listed microorganism or a prohibited or restricted microorganism under the former Chapter 150A, I believe would not have implicated HEPA because, again, in effect, what we're saying is that there is a, if you will, a vat or a system, a receptacle that is sitting on state property, and the question is, may the existing algae in that vat be replaced by different algae which will require a permit to be brought into the state? The permitting process existed under the prior law, under Chapter 150A, and it now exists in a much more rigorous form that applied in this case and was followed extensively in this case. And I believe the analogy to, in this case, it's a little more involved in a vat, but it's pre-existing. It's a system of circulating tubes in which the algae is placed. What was needed was simply a permit to put different algae into the existing system and grow it as they had grown other algae prior to this situation. And in this circumstance, where there is simply no alteration of the state facility or even of the use on the state premises at all, not even a different tenant, it's the same entity that had done the same kind of thing but with different algae, that this is a process.
It's a different algae.
Pardon me?
It's a different algae.
It is. Yes, it is, Your Honor, and that's exactly...
Why does that make a difference? And it's a genetically modified algae, something that had previously never been imported, as far as the record indicates.
I don't know that it had been imported under this specific... specific permit, but there have in fact been algae imports, as is indicated in citations to the record in our brief. GMO organisms have been brought in, and microorganisms have been brought into the state. This was the first permit I'm aware of in this situation for use at the Nelha facility.
Council, the legislature could have been specific, either in 343 or 150A, and just saying it doesn't apply, couldn't it? And we wouldn't be here, right? I mean, you're arguing the intent, but the legislature could have clearly, in the statute, just said the HIPAA doesn't apply. Isn't that right?
They certainly could have, Your Honor.
And since the lower court ruled in March of 2006, did the state go to the legislature to clarify the law?
Not to the state, no, Your Honor.
You didn't go to the legislature.
And may I also suggest, however, that in this kind of scenario, the board is not suggesting that Chapter 343 simply would never have any application if someone brought forward an application to import any kind of listed restricted algae. And by the way, I'm quite confident there are many different kinds of microorganisms that might offer far greater risks than the organism here, but that's not really the point.
Well, what would be the standard then on when it applies and when it doesn't apply?
I think the standard, Your Honor, would be that if the proposal was to build, to alter, expand, or somehow use in a substantially different way to change the use of state land or use state funds in a way that is more than simply changing the contents of an existing state processing facility.
But that's a different argument than you raised in your briefs that said that the enactment of the 2000 amendment repealed by implication the application of HIPAA. Your argument is that it doesn't apply, period. HIPAA doesn't apply, period. Not that it was repealed by implication.
I think to the extent that I don't think it's necessary to argue implied repeal, Your Honor. I believe that in this scenario, again, that Chapter 150A, which provides not merely a process for technical review, informing the public, and issuing a permit, they have the authority in addition, and they did it here, to impose conditions appropriate to the circumstance, and there were a number of conditions imposed here. They also have enforcement authority, so they can not only, unlike the environment.
Your argument is that it was superseded by implication by the more extensive permitting requirements enacted in 2000.
Yes, Your Honor, and again, not suggesting that if someone proposed to build a new facility on state property that the argument would then be, well, the environmental protection laws don't apply, you don't have to go through that review process. We're talking about an already existing, already environmentally reviewed facility that as far back as at least the 1985 EIS did contemplate production of
algae. Isn't that an argument that it should be exempted from HIPAA because no existing facilities are being altered? It's not an argument that HIPAA doesn't apply.
And clearly the National Energy Laboratory did follow HIPAA.
That's correct, Judge Watanabe. It did, and there's no suggestion, again, that Nelha would somehow be exempt from HIPAA if they were expanding or building new facilities, if you will, or altering old ones. But
do you believe that the 1985 EIS actually covered this particular situation? It seemed pretty conditional.
I think it depends on how precise we want to get, Your Honor. I mean, there's no question. As far as I know, there's no reference in the 1985 EIS to genetically modified algae. There is reference to contemplation of pharmaceutical development, of production of algae and so forth. The fact that the algae produced might be used either for human or animal feed or for fertilizer or for development of pharmaceuticals. I don't think the end use matters. And I think that the issue of what kind of algae might be there, again, was a matter entrusted by the specific direction of the legislature in Chapter 150A, the weighing and assessment of the risks and potential risks of bringing in a new kind of algae or a different kind of algae was vested in the Board of Agriculture, and quite clearly the intent of the legislature, with the express intent, was to, and they put it in terms of an urgent need to update and streamline.
Well, your argument in this appeal is not that this permit was exempt from HEPA, right? You're arguing that HEPA doesn't apply.
That's correct, Your Honor.
HEPA applies to any action by the state that involves the use of state or county land. So why isn't an importation of genetically engineered algae that's going to be grown or cultivated on state-owned property, why doesn't that involve an action involving state land?
I think because it would just simply defeat the process that the legislature established in Chapter 150A. I think it carries the idea simply too far. I mean, perhaps, and I don't want to get carried away, but I think you can argue that would essentially require that expansive a view, and I do well understand that Chapter 343 is a very broad provision. However, I think if it carried too far, you might say that there would have to be an environmental assessment to issue a driver's license because people are going to use state roads, even though there would be no change in the state roads and so on.
Well, how would you define the term use of state land as it's used in the HEPA statute then?
Well, in this circumstance, again, the use of the state land clearly involves the actual use of the facilities at Nelha for production of algae. And the difference is that it was for the same ongoing use production of algae that had been going on for 20 years prior to this application. The only difference is that under the permitting process here, because it was a new strain of algae coming in and it's a listed algae, then it had to be permitted to be brought in. But there was no different or expanded. In fact, there was a reduced use below to about 40% of the actual capacity of the systems that Merrill was using in the Nelha facility.
How do you think the Super Ferry decision affects this case?
I beg your pardon?
How do you believe the Super Ferry decision affects this case?
Your Honor, I think it doesn't. I mean, I'm a little, I suppose that's a charged way to put it, but the Super Ferry situation is so different in every respect. The Super Ferry decision by the Supreme Court is a very fine compendium of the cases and so forth, but I think Super Ferry involved both construction of physical improvements and changes in the facilities in Wailuku in particular, the exemption process was implicated there, as I understand it. And in this case, it's simply this is it. And in addition to which, of course, at this point, there's a statute now that explicitly applies to the large capacity ferry, I believe it is, where here what we have is the pre-existing statutory provisions for the very careful vetting process for issuing a permit, and no alteration of use.
The Supreme Court case indicated that secondary effects would be considered in deciding the scope of action within the meaning of the HEPA statute, correct?
I'm sorry, under one...
The Supreme Court Super Ferry case interpreted the pre-existing HEPA statute, and it it, one of the things that it did was it construed the term action, which is a triggering requirement for HEPA, to involve not only the direct action, but secondary effects. So in this case, doesn't that mean that we can't just look at whether this was a permit to allow the importation of genetically modified algae? We have to look at where was that algae going to be cultivated. So doesn't the action in this case encompass not only the board's granting the permit, but also consider what's going to happen after the permit is granted?
Well, and the permit process that the board went through did do that, and among other things, and unlike the environmental law, for instance, the board has follow-up authority and can even revoke the permit. That's something that doesn't happen with the EIS process. But in this circumstance, the action, I believe, perhaps the analogy here would be to the Public Utilities Commission consideration of the, I believe it was a certificate of use or public necessity, something like that. And even there, there was the related activity of construction in the port and so forth. Here, there was no such other activity. I mean, the existing use of the process, rather of the facilities, would be entirely unaltered, and they would actually be used even less than they were before, or at least less than their capacity.
You talked about the vetting process. Can you share a little bit more about who comprises this advisory board and how the vetting actually occurs? And you also mentioned that you folks provide public notice, but you're considering this to be a meeting, right? You're subjecting it to Chapter 92?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So there's no actual public notice in the newspaper where people can come and comment about your...
Other than the sunshine notice, if you will, the notices of public meeting and the agendas, of course, that are required to be filed. That's correct. They, in this case, were...
The Lieutenant Governor's office and on the door of the meeting site.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's essentially the same as any other public board meeting, for instance, that kind of thing. And in this case, of course, the information was sufficient. Part of the process here did involve a substantial turnout of people at board meetings, the two board meetings that were held, and submission of a volume of written testimonies as well. The process, once the initial application was received and it was decided that this was an above moderate risk organism, the matter was referred first to the subcommittee of the Plant and Animal Advisory Committee, which in effect is a panel of consultants, expert consultants that are picked by the chairman of the chairperson of the Board of Agriculture. From there, their comments and recommendations.
Are there boards that are subject to the Sunshine Law, or do they just meet in private?
The subcommittee is not, and they don't actually meet. They review the proposal and offer their comments and recommendations. Those go to the Plant and Animal Advisory Committee, which is established by statute and includes the chairperson of the Board of Agriculture, the chair of the, or the director of health, I believe director of Department of Land and Natural Resources, and also of the Office of Environmental Quality, and plus five other designees by the Board of Agriculture. That committee does meet under the Sunshine Laws with published notice and so forth, and then their comments and recommendations are referred to the Board of Agriculture, which again, with notice and published agenda and so forth, meets and reviews those comments and recommendations, and in this case did not have sufficient information to complete their to make a decision in the May, I believe it was, of 2005 meeting. and also time was running out on the time within which these permits can be approved, so they denied, and then considered the later version of the same application in June of 2005, at which point they, again, after hearing testimony and so forth, did approve the permit on substantial conditions.
I think the record indicates that everyone was, they just don't know, right, if these particular microorganisms are going to affect the environment, and there were a lot of very good concerns raised by the plaintiffs and all the people testifying, and I guess I wonder, every time a question came up about whether if there were a hurricane and the pipes all burst and all these organisms got, you know, dumped onto the lava, whether it was going to affect our environment, the board's response seemed to be to go back to the applicant and ask, well, is that true? And so is this more like a self-certification process, or is there a way to scientifically analyze all the information that's being raised about the environmental impacts?
I think both, Your Honor. I mean, of course, they got additional information from the applicant, but they also have their own people they would be inspecting as the process went on as well, of course. But in this case, I think the concerns were primarily not that the, there were a number of protections required with regard to the ability to quickly destroy all of this material and assure that it would not escape from the facility. The injection of chlorine, for instance, and the effort to ensure, especially if there was a storm or a casualty of some kind like that, to assure that this organism would be destroyed entirely.
Why was it classified as an above moderate risk?
Why was it? Among other reasons, Your Honor, it was that this was a GMO product, and they were not sure the extent, initially, as to the extent of any federal involvement. It was a new thing, new strain, and one that they had not dealt with before. And I think, as a matter of prudence and precaution, the chief of the plant quarantine—I believe I've got the title right—of the branch that first considers this prudently decided that this should be subject to the more careful scrutiny and requirements of this process. Thank you.
May it please this honorable court, Isaac Moriwaki of Earth Justice, on behalf of community groups Ohana Parakeao, Kohana Hiki Ohana, Shimo Free Hawaii, and Sierra Club Hawaii Chapter. These groups include residents of the Kona community on the Big Island who are seriously concerned about the potential impacts and risks of this biopharmaceutical algae project on their island home. This project seeks to manufacture in an outdoor environment on the Kona coast algae that's genetically modified to produce experimental and unapproved drugs. So the community groups brought this action to enforce environmental review mandates of Hawaii Revised Statutes Chapter 343, also known as the Hawaii Environmental Policy Act, or HEPA. Indeed, this project is precisely the kind of highly controversial and potentially dangerous activity that the legislature established HEPA to address, so that environmental consciousness would be raised, cooperation and coordination would be encouraged, and public participation during the process would benefit all the parties involved, as well as society as a whole. Defendant Board of Agriculture, however, has refused to comply even with the bare minimum, very first step of conducting an environmental assessment to determine whether this project may have a significant impact on Hawaii's environment and public health.
Can you tell me a little bit about the environmental assessment process? How long does it take? How much does it cost?
It varies depending on the case, but in some cases it can be very brief. Again, the entire analysis is whether a project may have a significant impact.
Who does it? Is it the government agency? Would it be the Board of Agriculture, or would it be the applicant?
Pursuant to the statute, the Board of Agriculture or the Department of Agriculture is mandated to conduct an environmental assessment.
Do you believe that HRS 91, 13.5 applies to these type of permits?
13, HRS 9.
That says that if they don't act on the permit within, in this case it would be 180 days, it would be automatically approved?
The board was under the assumption that that provision or something like it applied in this case. I haven't directly researched that issue, but the board did reject the applications without prejudice to refiling so that it could further consider the issue when the Republic Concerns raised. I don't think that requires necessarily, a ruling that HEPA doesn't apply because there's this time limit there. All the agencies, or many agencies, are subject to that time limitation, and yet many of them, if not all of them, duly comply with HEPA.
Let me ask you this. Is it correct that the triggering aspect of HEPA is that it has to be an action involving use of state or county land?
That's correct.
So in this case, if the company, instead of using the state facilities, had purchased privately their own property and put the same cultivating facilities on that private property, would HEPA apply?
No, it would not. At least it would not apply to the extent, of that first trigger of use of state and county lands.
Right. So in that situation, the Department of Agriculture would be the sole authority in granting or denying the permit without the need for an environmental assessment.
Yes. And that's the whole point in this case, that this project did involve the use of state and county lands. And in truth, the Board of Agriculture has never disputed this point throughout this entire case. Instead, it concocts this confusing sort of argument and goes through contortions trying to artificially sever its involvement in this case from the rest of the project, arguing that it only approved the mere act of importing the algae and nothing else. To the contrary, this misrepresents the BOA's actual authority, first of all, and it also misses the point of the environmental review law. It should be made clear that the BOA's authority covers not just the mere act of importation, but actually the import and possession of the microorganisms. This is expressly stated in HRS section 150-6.382. Furthermore, the regulations make absolutely clear that the BOA must review and authorize all aspects of the project and not just the mere importation. For example, Hawaii Administrative Rules Section 4-71A-4B provides that the application for the import and possession must contain a whole range of info, including description of the proposed use of the algae, description and location of the facility, description of equipment and procedures, including a floor plan, blueprint, that addresses, among other things, design and construction, work and storage, equipment, plumbing, air handling, biosafety, and on and on. Subsection C of that same rule directs that where import possession requires the board's approval, as in this case, the applicant must submit information on the microorganism's potential impact on Hawaii's environment and public health. Section 471A7F provides that the board may impose all kinds of conditions, including conditions relating to time, place, use of the organism. And Section 471A10 mandates that site inspection and approval by the department are required. I mean, these make clear that the board is concerned not only with the mere act of importation, but all aspects of the project. And indeed, the board itself has emphasized throughout this case that it viewed the entire project and imposed all kinds of conditions, and it reviewed all aspects.
So one of the arguments that the Department of Agriculture makes is that we have to be careful about how we define the word use in HEPA, use of state or county lands, because their point is everything potentially involves the use of county land. If you drive on a road to take your microorganisms to private land, you have to drive on the road, or you're going to have to use state facilities to import anything. So what is your view of how the term use of state or county land should be interpreted in terms of its scope under the HEPA statute?
Well, as the board has admitted, yes, this term use is purposefully broad. It's very expansive. And it contrasts with other language and other triggers that specifically mention things like construction and facilities. So, I mean, under settled canons of statutory construction, this disparate language is deemed to be purposeful and must be given effect. Now, in this case, I don't think there's any question but that this constitutes a use of state land. This project is going to be located entirely and exclusively on state land. As Judge Watanabe pointed out before, Neoha understood that this use of this land subjected this facility to HEPA. And even after the EISs, there have been some follow-up reviews, categorical exemptions, environmental assessments involving HEPA. So there's clearly understanding that this is state land, and when you use the state land for a project, it triggers HEPA. Now, as for the speculative hypotheticals that the Board of Agriculture is throwing out, I would point out that the Hawaii Supreme Court has suggested a limiting principle in the Citizens for the Protection of the North Kohala Coastline case when it indicated that the underpasses that were going to be constructed in state lands in that case and that triggered HEPA for the entire project were an integral part or integral aspect of the project. And so if the court is searching for a way to somehow limit the absurd results, that could be one way, one principle to limit the potentially absurdly, the potentially overly expansive scope of HEPA.
Your principle would be that the use of state land has to be an integral part of the project.
That's one principle that the Hawaii Supreme Court has suggested. And I think, if anything, in this case, it's a lot clearer case than the Kahana Sunset, the citizen cases, the citizen for the protection of the North Kohala coastline case, as well as the Coral Ridge case, the Sierra Club v. OSP case. In those cases, there was a tiny piece of state land that triggered review for the entire project. If anything, that would be more than stretched than in this case, where this project is entirely contained within state land. It's exclusively using state land. And I think there's no question, again, that this constitutes use of state land under the plain language of the HEPA statute.
Council, would you concede that the primary law to protect the public and the environment from microorganisms that may be imported that would have an adverse effect is Chapter 150A, not 343?
That's correct. And yet, the question is, as the BOA puts it, does that somehow override or render HEPA superfluous?
Now, what does 150A lack that 343 has, other than the public participation process, to accomplish that purpose?
Many things. It doesn't require the production of a written document, such as an EA or an EIS. As you said, it does not require the full public participation, scoping in the very beginning of the process, as well as production of a draft document that the public can review and provide input regarding, and no final determination that there will be no significant impact.
Would your view be different if the Board of Agriculture conducted contested case proceedings on these permit applications?
It would be no different, particularly given controlling precedent, starting with the Kahana Sunset case, where the Hawaii Supreme Court made very clear that even after the Maui Planning Commission conducted a 13-day contested case and issued written conclusions and findings that this was not a functional equivalent of an environmental assessment, the Supreme Court wouldn't go there, and it said very clearly that this written findings and conclusions based on a contested case would not excuse that agency in that case from complying with HEPA.
If the 1985 environmental impact statement, I mean, they went the full gamut, had included genetically modified algae in the discussion, would you be here today?
If it had included a hard look at specific impacts posed by this particular project, then it would have fulfilled the requirements of HEPA. The bottom line, though, is that it's not a game of find the word, as the BOA puts it, where it picks through this EIS, and because it can find terms like aquaculture, mariculture, or marine biotechnology, or even pharmaceutical development, that suffices for any and all projects that may possibly fit these labels. As the law provides, there must be a quote-unquote hard look at the specific risks and impacts of this particular project. And there hasn't been that mandated hard look in this case.
Don't we understand a little bit about genetically modified organisms? I mean, how is this algae different from what Mendel used to do when he crossed peas? What's the difference, or what makes it much more dangerous?
Right. I'm not a scientist, but from what I understand, it's very different in the sense that we're doing something that nature would never do itself. We're forcibly inserting genes into an organism, sometimes crossing humans with animals, humans with plants, plants with animals, and it's something that has, and all scientists recognize this, potential unintended risks. And the point is, when you have a novel organism like this, there needs to be a proper risk assessment of what the potential human health impacts are, the impacts to the environment. Also, not only does the trait of being genetically modified, algae, matter in this case, but also the fact that it's growing unapproved experimental drugs. There's a process. It's Dr. Lauren Pang, a medical doctor and an expert that testified in this case, established. There's a process for drugs to be approved by the FDA. And none of these experimental pharmaceutical substances have gone through that process, and yet here they are, releasing these organisms in an open air environment, in an outdoor environment, where as many people established, including the person that built this particular facility, there's ample and extensive opportunities for escape. The expert, the scientist that documented and discovered the existence of this particular base organism, Chlamydomonas, in Hawaii, he testified all the way from Texas, saying that your claims that this would die if it escaped into the environment are completely unfounded. This organism is found all over Hawaii, and it can survive in all kinds of environments. And so, two things: the genetically modified nature of this organism is a wild card, and then the further production of unapproved experimental drugs is also something that demands a proper risk assessment.
And all this could be done if it were on private land.
It could be done if it was on private land, and the BOA went through its proper process without HEPA review.
So it's not HEPA that's protecting the environment, it's the 150A in the Board of Agriculture, right?
That's the primary permitting process, and yet the question is not whether the legislature intended the existence of that exclusive permitting process, as the BOA calls it, to override the mandates of HEPA where it does apply. Again, there's no question.
As far as this parade of horribles that you put out there, and I don't question that such things can happen, but it is 150A that is to protect the public and the environment, because the only distinction is private or state land.
That's correct. But the question is whether the legislature intended, where 150A does trigger the HEPA process, whether the legislature intended that process to enlighten the board's decision.
When 150A was amended by Act 211, the legislature said this was meant to facilitate and streamline the procedures for the importation of microorganisms. Was this accomplished if 343 applies?
There's no indication that it wouldn't be.
However,
the bare minimum EA requirement can be something that's very routine and automatic.
Okay. If that 211 didn't some way exempt this process from 343, how was the process streamlined and facilitated?
Well, first of all, I think we need to address that the initial premise that that Act in 2000 somehow impliedly repealed HEPA. That's certainly not the case.
Well, I'm not saying that. Assuming it didn't for a moment, I understand your argument. How was this process streamlined?
Well, to just simply focus on the legislative purpose to facilitate and streamline, and And mind you, all that happened in that 2000 Act was that they reorganized the sections, and there were more explicit provisions for imported microorganisms as opposed to other organisms. But assuming that that was one of the intents to facilitate and streamline, that didn't mean that the legislature intended to throw out the window any other protections and the underlying intent to control biological pollution.
Assuming for a moment it did not throw out HEPA, how was the process streamlined and facilitated?
It was facilitated, at the very least, by allowing the HEPA review process to enlighten the board decision-making, as the legislature expressly stated in its purpose.
That would have existed, though, before the Act 211, right? HEPA would have applied before Act 211?
Yes.
So, did 211 accomplish anything as far as streamlining and facilitating the application?
Well, it certainly did it in its own terms as far as reorganizing the structure of the 150A law. The pertinent question here is what we have to get to is whether in expressing that underlying intent of that particular act of facilitating and streamlining when it reorganized the statute, did it intend to impliedly repeal HEPA? And I think it's very clear that they're not.
Well, I think Judge Foley is asking that if that's the intent, and if the statute didn't otherwise streamline it, then what could it mean except to say that it's streamlined the process by implicitly superseding HEPA? In other words, if there's no other way that the process was streamlined by the amendment to the statute, then isn't that a fair inference that what the legislature was talking about was taking away the HEPA requirement?
Well, I think it's a sort of false assumption to assume that a HEPA requirement would necessarily drag out this process, and that the legislature was specifically thinking, when the HEPA already pre-existed, the amendment, that in streamlining it, by reorganizing these particular provisions, we're going to throw out any possible conditions.
Well, did reorganizing the provisions streamline the process?
It streamlined the process on its own terms, yes. The actual provisions. Excuse me.
How did it do that?
Again, it broke out certain sections. What it did was it made more specific the provisions, and it clarified, I think, that the intent to clarify is also contained in the legislative history. It clarified the procedures for importing various kinds of organisms. It broke out microorganisms as opposed to plants and animals. And so there was a sort of reorganization within that structure. The question again, is there a implied repeal based simply on that underlying legislative history and ignoring the bottom line of that 158 statute, which is to protect the Hawaii's environment and animal, plant, human health from biological pollution.
How do you envision the timeline to work? Okay, the applicant submits their application for a permit to bring in these organisms. Then what should the agency be doing? Are they supposed to immediately go out and do an environmental assessment? How do they meet that 180-day timeline?
That's correct. The HEPA precedent is very clear that HEPA review must occur at the earliest practical time. And so once...
If it's a government agency and they're going to spend funds, they've got to go out to bid, probably, to get a consultant to do this environmental assessment. It's going to take time to do that environmental assessment unless you think the government employees can do it. Is that what you're expecting, or is this something that has to go out to experts to do?
That's something that the Board of Agriculture probably can answer better than me. I assume there are experts in-house at the Department and the Department of Agriculture that could conduct this analysis. If not, it emphasizes all the more so that there needs to be some sort of deliberate process. And again, the legislature intended HEPA to assist that process, as well as bring in the public and experts such as Dr. Brown, experts such as Mr. Bilan, who helped design the facility, and Dr. Pang, a medical expert, so that they can provide input into this process. Finally, the point regarding the EISs and whether they cover this algae project. Actually, the BOA relied on two EISs before the circuit court. The first was conducted actually in 1976. But that EIS, by its terms, only covered the construction of infrastructure for phase one of NOAA and specifically stated that future projects would require their own environmental review. The BOA is thus left only with the 1985 EIS, which was conducted 20 years ago. 20 years ago, this facility did not exist, this applicant did not exist, and there was no such thing as the technology or even the idea of growing in an open-air environment algae that's genetically modified to produce experimental drugs. Again, the bottom line is that there must be that mandated hard look, and that hard look has not taken place in this case.
Let me ask you this. Did the Department of Agriculture argue in the court below that they were exempt from HEPA based upon the non-alteration of the facility?
They did.
What was the court's ruling on that?
The court did not rule on that, and the DOA did not appeal that point. And I think that's very key, as Your Honor pointed out. The BOA tries to concoct all kinds of exemptions of its own to HEPA's broad mandate, saying there must be construction, there must be facilities. As its sole support, it cites a single legislative committee report talking about growth and development, when the plain language must control in this case, again, the use of state lands. And there's, they have never disputed that this case involves the use of state lands.
Let me ask another question. Has there ever been a case decided in a non-construction context in which a court has found that HEPA applied to a permitting process? Something similar to this case. In other words, is there authority on this situation similar to this case in which the court has found that HEPA applies?
I'm not aware of a published court decision on that. I did submit for the record, however, many examples of HEPA review documents that address activities that do not involve construction or facilities.
Can you give me some examples?
There's a wedding, there was some kind of wedding service on state lands, I believe, was one, and there was another project that was going to eradicate or control birds around the airport, and others. They're contained in the record, and I cite them in my brief. But
so in the secretary case, I think there's a footnote about how the Public Utilities Commission declined to decide whether HEPA was implicated because they said Department of Transportation was taking care of it. But should the PUC have required a HEPA review before issuing the certificate of public convenience and necessity?
Yes, if it was a connected action. In the Superfund case, the Supreme Court added that footnote that the community groups in that case did not challenge the PUC's approval. And the ultimate ruling was this was not a connected action, and so it wasn't part of the overall project. I think the Superfair case, although it does provide some helpful insight in this case, has to be distinguished from this case on one basis at least, and that's, in that case, we're talking about an agency action, and it was the agency constructing a similar facility on Kahului Harbor, and the question was, what were the secondary impacts expanding beyond that particular action? In this case, we're talking about an applicant action. A long line of Supreme Court precedent establishes that in applicant actions, we're looking at the entire project. The action is defined as a program or project, and so we start with the entire project starting from importation, including the use of state lands. This is made clear in the Kahana Sunset case, the Coral Ridge case, as well as the citizen cases. Regarding the categorical exemption argument, again, the BOA did argue categorical exemptions below before the circuit court, but it has abandoned any such arguments on appeal. This constitutes waiver of these arguments. And this is significant because, as the Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled, these duly promulgated categorical exemptions are the exclusive avenue for exempting projects from HEPA, Kaha Sunset case, unless the project is exempt under a categorical exemption, preparation of an EA is mandatory. There is, in fact, a categorical exemption that covers operations, repairs, maintenance of existing structures, facilities, equipment, or topographical features involving negligible or no expansion or change or use beyond that previously existing. Again, the BOA has abandoned any argument of such exemptions on appeal. These are waived, but for the record, the community groups would add one brief update based on the Super Fair case and the federal cases that we provided the supplemental authorities. These cases instruct that agencies must comply with some sort of process to determine whether categorical exemptions apply, and they can't simply argue the categorical exemptions post hoc, as the BOA is trying to do here.
So you're saying in this case, when the BOA first rendered its decision, it didn't rely upon a categorical exemption argument?
That's correct.
And so you're saying because they didn't do that, they're now forever barred from raising that issue? Not this is the Circuit Court. I'm talking about when they first issued their decision.
Right. Because when they issued the decision, they didn't go through some kind of process. And again, the courts made clear that there is some sort of process required to a determination, consultation, to determine whether categorical exemption applies. Of course, they called it arbitrary or capricious, erroneous. In this case, it was a procedural matter, so it was, as a matter of law, erroneous for the Board of Agriculture to issue its approval without going through at least that process. And again, that's assuming that the categorical exemption applied in the first place, where, yes, it addresses operations, repairs, maintenance of existing facilities, but conditions it on saying there must be negligible or no expansion or change in the use. Again, as all the cases established, the failure to follow this process is dispositive. I'd just like to revisit one more time the argument by the board that its process under 158 is somehow preempts or HIPAA or is a functional equivalent. The Hawaii Supreme Court has repeatedly addressed this argument. In the Kahana Sunset case, again, there was a 13-day trial, written findings and conclusions. In the Coral Ridge case, there were findings and conclusions, a decision and order that the Supreme Court described as detailed and covered all the environmental impacts. The court refused to excuse the preparation of a required EA, saying that reading the two statutes in prior materia, the preparation of an EA pursuant to Chapter 343 would assist the BOA in considering the impacts as required by Chapter 158. In this case, the BOA would definitely have benefited from the enhanced decision-making and full public input and participation that HIPAA provides. Again, numerous experts testified to various, a wide array of impacts, possible mitigation, and available alternatives that the board, in its haste to approve this project, simply brushed aside. Also, as far as implied repeal goes, again, there's no argument there's an express appeal because no express provision repealing HIPAA exists. The standards are very stringent. Unless there is a plainly irreconcilable conflict, we must preserve both statutes and not render one meaningless. Effect will be given to both statutes if possible. Again, the underlying intent of Chapter 158, one that was not modified by the subsequent amendments to facilitate and streamline the permitting of microorganisms, is that the board must provide effective control of biological pollution, which is one of the most serious pollution problems facing Hawaii. This purpose does not irreconcilably conflict with the purpose of HIPAA. These statutes can work together, and the law mandates that they must. In conclusion, this case is simply the latest in a growing line of cases of agencies seeking to evade HIPAA's bare minimum EA requirement. By now, this trend has become more than a little disturbing. 30 years after the legislature established HIPAA, we're still arguing the very basics, whether it applies, whether exemptions apply. Going round and round on points that the Hawaii Supreme Court has repeatedly established. In fact, preparation of an EA should be routine and automatic, a bare minimum first step to determine whether this project may significantly impact Hawaii's fragile environment and public health. The Board of Agriculture's fixation on its own so-called exclusive process in an attempt to circumvent this basic mandate simply highlights the reason and need for HEPA review in the first place. To broaden the BOA's perspective, enhance decision-making, encourage public participation, and benefit all the parties involved, including the BOA, as well as society as a whole. Therefore, the community groups respectfully request this court to affirm the circuit courts to grant a summary judgment in their favor, requiring the BOA to prepare at least an EA prior to approving the biopharmaceutical algae project. Thank you.
I believe I have approximately 5 minutes. Your Honor, I wanted to stress to respond to a couple of points. There was a suggestion or an outright statement that the production here would be in the open air, that the GMO algae would be released into the environment. It is not in the open air. It's enclosed in these so-called photobioreactors. And quite frankly, a major point of the conditions that were imposed in the permit were to prevent release of any of this organism into the environment.
Do you agree that the state has waived the exemption argument?
No, Your Honor. It is true that at the time of approving the permits, the exemption process was not invoked. I believe, in fact, there likely would be an exemption, but that has not been an issue in this case.
Right. That's not something that we could rule on in the first instance, then.
I beg your pardon?
We couldn't decide this case based upon the exemption in the first instance, then, since the department never relied upon it in its decision-making.
I'm not sure that would be true, Your Honor. I mean, I think if the process is exempt, I think the court could still find. The fact that the board did not rely on it, I think, would amount to the familiar rule that they may have applied the wrong reason, but they were right, and that the board's decision could be upheld on that basis, which would of course result in reversing the circuit court. I think it is important, as the court's questions have suggested too, to focus on the point that the legislature expressly intended to facilitate and streamline the process of permitting and carefully considering the application for permits for organisms of this kind, including GMO.
Are there any cases that have involved the court ruling that HEPA has been preempted? I think that's the right word. I use supersede and repeat, but I think preempted is the right word. Preempted by implication, by a statutory permitting scheme. I mean, is there any authority that says or that is held in that kind of situation that the enactment of the statute has preempted by implication HEPA?
I don't have any specific authorities. I believe, and again, I can't cite a case as I stand here other than what may be in the brief, but in effect, application of HEPA in this case process that's required to be followed, arguably that process in and of itself was not more streamlined than what existed before. The legislature did not want to simply open the door and bring in whatever might be financially beneficial to the state without regard to consequences. They required that the Board of Agriculture, including the structure of advisory committees and subcommittees, that it carefully consider these applications. The rules that were adopted under the authority of Chapter 150A provide very specific requirements for what the applicant must submit. And then again, of course, that's vetted in the process of considering as provided by the rules and the statute.
But seed companies that brought in genetic modified corn, and have they had to go through the Department of Agriculture?
I believe the court's referring to the test raising of GMO corn in particular, that's been the subject of other litigation, and that kind of importation and growing is 100% governed by federal law. The state actually has no decision-making authority in that process at all, and basically is informed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and has input, but doesn't permit and doesn't it assists the federal process in monitoring that. But that's a completely different process.
Expressly preempts the state law.
I believe, in fact, it does, Your Honor. The import of, for instance, the GMO corn, that's under the Federal Plant Protection Act and related rules that do, in fact, preempt the state. This is in an area that is one of the reasons, I believe, why there was some uncertainty initially as to what the relationship, if any, would be between federal involvement in this application and state, and it was determined that this was not one of the federally regulated ones. This was entirely under the state's process, which was followed in its considerable detail. And finally, far from simply blowing off, if you will, the state law regarding the environment, it was carefully followed as specifically laid down by the legislature in 2000 with the intention of protecting the environment as well as advancing the purposes the legislature had in mind.
Let me ask one question. Do you agree that any question about the applicability of HEPA would be eliminated if the algae was going to be cultivated on private land?
I believe, yes, Your Honor. I mean, the process of under HEPA, that would not apply simply because there would not be a use of state land or funds.
Okay, we'll take the case under advisement. Thank you.